We are not a religious organisation, but an organisation of people who are concerned about the gift of cultural values in our community. And as a result, we thought that we ought to put something together in order to highlight the fact that religious values serves a very good purpose for the community. People who have religious values can make a contribution to the betterment of society. And as a result, we put together the Ambrose Centre for Religious Liberty as a human rights organisation. That is, working in the belief that laws in society, in fact, affect the culture, adversely sometimes, where you have what you might call anti-religious secular laws. Most people go away with the idea that suddenly, whatever the law says, is also the moral thing to do. Speak closer?
Yeah.
I want to get away from this. All right. So that's the first point about the Ambrose Centre. We are concerned for the drifting cultural values. We are concerned for the changes in laws, in particular in Australia, anti-discrimination laws, but overseas, laws also around the human rights charters, which manifest themselves in various equality laws, which have had a very, very bad and adverse effect on the rights of individuals and institutions to manifest their beliefs in public. Now, religious views and religious beliefs are not to be taken lightly. We in Australia can be very complacent about this. But you only have to read in this morning's press of the number of people who have been killed in overseas countries because of their Christian beliefs. We saw just 2 or 3 years ago various monks in Burma, in Tibet, all of whom were being killed because they had a fundamental belief in their life that God existed or God of their choice existed and that it was worth defending that belief. And so what we're talking about here, the manifestation of your religious beliefs in public, is not an idle reflection, but rather something of significance which you can play out in your own life. And if you don't play it out in your own life, you have the right to search for that belief as to the meaning of it. Now, the human rights aspect of religious belief can be found in the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights. And it's Article 18 that explains what that fundamental right is. And it says, everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience and religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief and freedom either alone or in community with others and in public or private to manifest his religion or belief in worship, teachings, practice and observance. You note the word that goes beyond just having the belief to the point of manifesting your belief. That is, to put on display what you believe. And then the second part of this particular fundamental right says, freedom to manifest one's religion or belief shall be subject only to such limitations as are prescribed by law and are necessary in a democratic society in the interest of public safety for the protection of public order, health or morals, or for the protection of the rights and freedoms of others. So it's an absolute right, subject only to very, very minor limitation. And that limitation draws on the welfare of the society generally. Now I'm going to give you a few cases. I'll start off with overseas cases, where despite the fact that we have an international law which recognises this fundamental right and freedom to manifest the belief, it doesn't always follow. And I'm going to concentrate mainly on the United Kingdom. Why the United Kingdom? That's a good question, of course, why? But it's the origin of where our laws have originated and from which our laws continue to be practiced. It's the foundation of a common law, even though the common law itself was in fact a flow over from the ecclesiastical law at one stage. Nonetheless, the common law is what dictates the making of our laws in Australia. There was a particular case called Shabina Begum, a young girl who wanted to wear the Islamic hijab to school. The school refused, it was taken to the courts, and the courts just simply said this: the article, referring to Article 18, does not require that one should be allowed to manifest one's religion at any time or place of one's choosing. And that seems to be a reasonable conclusion. That word, you can't put on display your religious belief by going into a mosque and saying, look, I'm a Catholic. Why don't you stop your service and let me preach my service? You can't just do that. So in context, that seems fair enough. Yet, when we see other cases, a different story emerges. For instance, in the case of Shirley Chaplin, who was a nurse of 30 years standing, she was wearing a cross in a nursing home. It was on public display what she believed. The employer terminated her because she was wearing the cross. So, when it went to the employment tribunal, had this to say: there is no mandatory requirement of a Christian faith that a Christian should wear a crucifix. In other words, she couldn't manifest her belief, had lost her job because she believed in wearing the cross. In another case of Nadia Awida, a British Airways employee, also wearing a cross, told to take it off, failure to take it off would lead to her termination. She refused to take it off, making clear that the cross represented something very significant in her life, saying very strong words that the cross was an icon to which other people would identify with, and it would had some meaning and significance in her life. British Airways didn't relent. She took the matter off to the various courts, and in the end, she lost every case. But nonetheless, what the court said: a visible display of a cross was not a requirement of a Christian faith. So here is a court. You see, this is the point. Here is a court that's saying to you, or to the public at large, what is significant in your belief. The court is not determining whether the belief is valid or not valid. Simply saying, publicly, we will determine what can be significant, not you, in contravention of international law. And yet, in another case, a young girl wanted to wear the Sheikh Kara bracelet to school, and the court and the school wouldn't permit that because it was a breach of the school uniform. She took that off to the court as well, and the court in this particular case said this: the claimant is not obliged by her religion to wear a kara. It is clearly, in her case, an extremely important inclination of her faith, and allowed her to wear the kara. The inconsistent position between a Christian belief and a non-Christian belief. Now, Lord Patton, for those of you who don't know, Lord Patton was in fact the governor of Hong Kong before the colony reverted back to the Chinese back in the 1990s. Now, Lord Patton has recently just been appointed as the chairman of the BBC in England. And he said on his appointment that he regarded himself as a cradle Catholic, whatever that means. He's born a Catholic, that's what he's saying, and continues to be a Catholic. His own experience was that people looked down on him intellectually for having religious beliefs. Now, it prompted the president of the Secular Society of England to say that Patton's ability to be impartial as the chairman of the BBC was in doubt because of his religious beliefs. Now, that's a case where a person cannot manifest a religious belief because you'll be called, as Tony Blair referred to, a nutter by the public because you have religious beliefs. Now, in the case of a Jewish school where the chief rabbi refused to enroll a student because the student was not of the same orthodox Judaism as the school, the mother of the student took the rabbi to the Supreme Court of England, and the Supreme Court ruled that the rabbi had no right to declare who was and who was not sufficiently Jewish to enrol in the school. Now that is quite an appalling position, because it's a bit like saying to the Catholic Church, if you like, we will tell you who you can and cannot admit, not only to your school, but also into your seminaries, because you are not permitted to regulate your own institution, where that institution might act outside the Human Rights Charter. Now, we have similar cases like that in Australia, where the courts have determined what institutions can and cannot do. And I'm just going to refer to a couple in Queensland. One is the Bundaberg Baptist Church just recently wanted to employ a field officer, if you like, for want of a better name, someone who would go out and spread the message of the Baptist Church. And so they placed an advertisement, and they put some conditions down on the advertisement that the person had to be a Christian, but needed to attend the Baptist service every week and proclaim the Baptist vision. Now, a member of the Church of England who was familiar with the community of the Baptist Church in Bundaberg applied for the job, but was rejected because she wouldn't agree to attend the Sunday services. That was taken to the court, and the Supreme Court of Queensland, in this case, deemed the Baptist Church Bundaberg to be discriminating, because it simply said that a person of an Anglican faith was as good as a person of a Baptist church. And therefore, the Baptist Church in Bundaberg had no right to regulate its affairs in accordance with their own faith, but had to take anybody of goodwill. You might be scandalised to think that that would happen, but the Queensland Anti-Discrimination Law today does not give the Catholic Church the automatic right to appoint their own teachers. The Catholic Church cannot, under the law in Queensland, presume to only employ Catholic teachers or Catholic people in any position at the school. The exception it makes in terms of an automatic right is where that person will be teaching religion, because religion is considered to be a core subject, and therefore the church has that right. But any other person who applies, a faith or no faith, of whatever sexual orientation, applies for the position of geography teacher or history teacher, cannot, because of their views or their lifestyle, be rejected merely on those grounds. The law does not permit it in Queensland. So much for the right of people to manifest their religious beliefs. Tell you about the case of St. Vincent de Paul, which also went to the Anti-Discrimination Tribunal in Queensland, where St. Vincent de Paul wished only to appoint a person who was of a Catholic faith to act as a regional chairperson. A woman who who was not of a Catholic faith, but claimed to be of a Christian belief, but wasn't sure if the resurrection actually took place, but could accept it. She inadvertently was elected to the position of chairperson, and when St. Vincent de Paul politely asked her to stand down, and she refused, and when she refused to stand down, they removed her by the rules of the organisation, she took that off the court. And the Anti-Discrimination Tribunal held that St. Vincent de Paul had discriminated against this woman on the grounds of her religious beliefs, which were not of a Catholic belief, and that St. Vincent de Paul might in fact be enriched by allowing our diversity of religious views to operate inside its ranks. But the more important thing is that St. Vincent de Paul could not act in a way consistent with the Catholic ethos, with the Catholic requirements, and with the Catholic beliefs in the way that dispenses with charity or in the way it dispenses with welfare. It was at the mercy of the court. Now, having told you about some of these cases, let me just turn to two matters that are sort of raging a bit around Australia. Of course, I'm referring to euthanasia and same-sex marriage. Now, with same-sex marriage, I'll start off with euthanasia. It might be easier that way. We seem to be more on a winner than what we are with same-sex marriage. Euthanasia, of course, presents itself as a state issue. Euthanasia is not what you might call within the jurisdiction of the federal government. Any state government or territory, if Bob Brown had his own way, would have the right to legislate on euthanasia. Now, euthanasia is presented not so much as killing, but as mercy assistance to people who are terminally ill. Or, alternatively, as complying with the wishes of a person who chooses to die and that they ought to be assisted if they're suffering a terminal illness and are close to death. And therefore, it seemed to be an act of charity. That's the way it's presented. Now, unfortunately, those who oppose euthanasia sometimes get the issues a little bit muddled and are not quite clear on what euthanasia really means. Euthanasia does not mean circumstances where life support systems are removed as a matter of necessity or as a matter of the family's wishes. It does not mean where additional medication might be prescribed in order to relieve pain, but in fact shortens life if the intention is to relieve the pain. It does not mean where a person has left a living will. Living will may have been, in fact, drafted 5 years before the event, but a person who clearly has stated his or her intention that should they reach a particular point in their life where their bodies don't function too well or they're totally dependent on medical aid, and that the medical authorities respect that will and allow that person to die, that is not euthanasia. And it creates great controversy sometimes as to understanding what euthanasia is. Euthanasia is where there is an intervention by another person to abet or to counsel someone towards suicide, or towards an act that will result in the death of that person, or who actively assists the person in taking steps to end their life. Now that is euthanasia. Now that is to be distinguished between the moral position of a person choosing the suicide and the legal position. Now, we just need to be careful. Suicide is not a criminal act. A it might be an act that is not preferred, that people ought to be dissuaded from it, and that morally it is not a correct decision, but that is not the law. The law is that suicide is not a criminal act. The same thing with people who take decisions by way of a living will. It may not be the moral position, it may not be the preferred position, it may be a position that in fact angers and grieves family members. But it is not euthanasia. And that's the point we need to understand. Euthanasia is a direct intervention by a third party by way of abetting, encouragement, counselling, or in some other way, direct granting of a of perhaps medicine that will bring about death. It's a direct intervention. Now we need to understand what we're talking about here. We are told that people who no longer have a usefulness in the society ought to be, in fact, assisted to die. And that sometimes people who are placed under pressure to bring about their death in order to relieve the inconvenience to others. That sort of situation is, in fact, the intervention of a third party. That is not permitted, and nor do we want that. A person who is competent, not suffering depression, and clearly understands what the situation is by bringing about his or her death, might be okay legally. Morally is a separate question. But the person who aids and abets such circumstance is not acting lawfully. Now, if the people in support of euthanasia were to get their own way, then that would become the norm. It would become the norm to encourage, to assist, to counsel, and to do whatever is possible to assist people to bring a premature end to their lives. Which means that we would create a vulnerable class in the community, particularly the elderly, and particularly those in nursing homes, where the culture would simply be, what is the point of this person staying alive? And for all of the faults that we can claim about the jurisdiction in Canada, where there are some very questionable issues, there's a famous case that the Supreme Court took in Canada called Sue Rodriguez's case, where the court held that the reason they would not grant legalisation of euthanasia is because it would create the vulnerable with a fear which could not be constrained by the law. The fear of people in elderly nursing homes, the fear of people who are totally dependent on the care of others, to the point that they realise that in the Netherlands today, where they do have legalised euthanasia, they now carry, many old people carry a card, I do not wish to be euthanised. Because the society has slipped so gravely into the slippery slope of the culture and the value of life becomes secondary to the industry of reducing the debts of a state by not carrying people in the health system who will die and have no utility. In the state of Arizona of the United States, there was a case yet to be decided where, in fact, two people who run the pro-euthanasia organisation put to death a person whom they claimed was the wish of a person. They claimed that the person was in great pain. But the family has given evidence to the court that the person who was deceased was in no pain, was not suffering a terminal illness, but in fact had a mental incapacity. And she was put to death by this pro-euthanasia group on the basis that she had decided she did not wish to continue to live. Now therein stands the dangers of what is and what is not euthanasia. That is a clear case, if not of murder, certainly of manslaughter. But the jury has not determined that matter as yet. And in Australia, where we are having a debate on euthanasia, it is best that we are clear, that we understand precisely what it is that we're talking about. It is not a question here of simply saying that health of workers ought to be given exemptions. Exemptions do not treat the issue. Exemptions simply hive you off as an irrelevant part of a debate. This is an issue of ethics, an issue of culture. This is an issue of dignity and respect for the human body and the human person. And we should not underestimate what the issue is all about. By surrendering the argument to some merciful concept of trying to assist someone die with dignity. That is not doing that at all. That is in fact being totally disrespectful to the person's life and to the dignity of the body of that person. Let me turn also to the question of same-sex marriage. Now, there are two or three headings here that those proponents of same-sex marriage argue upon. One is a question of equality. Secondly is a question of fairness. And the third one is you are discriminating against the homosexual community because they can't get married like heterosexuals can get married. One of the arguments here is, of course, that family is based on marriage. And we ought to be quick to recognise and to admit that marriage is a damaged institution at the moment. And we shouldn't be afraid to admit that. Perhaps it reflects the change in our cultural values. Perhaps it reflects the decline of our moral standards. Perhaps it may reflect the liberation of sexual mores. Whatever it is, marriage is a damaged state. Damaged institution, the number of people who live outside of marriage and cohabitate, the number of children who are born out of wedlock, the very high divorce rates, the level of unfaithfulness in marriage. All of those things are true. But not one of them destroys the foundation of what the functionality of marriage is all about. And it's the functionality of marriage that we need to be able to debate. But the functionality of marriage does not in any way confuse the genders. Same-sex marriage, in fact, says that we do not have genders per se, because two men or two women are the same as a man and a woman. Now, a man that's been married for many, many years like I have still can't work out my wife. Father George, you'll forgive me for saying that. But you see, that's the diversity. That's the benefit of the opposites. They don't get their roles confused. They have a function to perform jointly in unity. They are two special creatures that God has given birth to for the purpose, principally of procreation. But procreation doesn't always happen. Some people choose not to. Some people marry after the time that they're capable of procreating. That's okay. But their function is still procreated in union with one another. It is not destroyed. It is the function of the species, of the genders. But they unite in a way that's unique only to a man and a woman. Two men and two women don't unite in the same way. Two men and two women are not in fact made for one another. By any biological test, by any test of anatomy, they are not made for one another. It is not a natural, normal relationship. And we should not be afraid to say so. It is unnatural. It is not normal. Nonetheless, we're told that we have to believe, in order to remove discrimination, we have to believe that it is natural, that it is normal, and it's the same as a heterosexual relationship. That is for us to deny the centrality of truth. Put aside the way God made us, but the centrality of truth of what we see in each one of us, in the expressions of each of the genders, and the role that each gender plays, and that man and woman are made for one another. And yet, we say we have to put that aside because it removes discrimination and it restores equality. But there is no equality. Because the equality of the function and the act between man and woman is not of an equal standing, an equal status to the activities in a sexual union between two men or two women. It is entirely different. There is nothing equal about it. And we need to tell the truth. It cannot be said that in any way we are discriminating. It cannot be said that in some ways we're not being equal. And it cannot be said that we're not being fair. Unless, of course, some people want to extend the argument, but I personally can accept completely that two men or two women in a relationship of their own can love one another, and obviously do, and can be passionate with one another. But that is a private matter between them. It is not a public matter. What we've been asked to do in the same-sex marriage debate is to pretend it becomes a public matter. And once it becomes a public matter, then the law must change. Not only in the redefinition of marriage, but also in your practices and in your rights and what the church can preach and what it can't preach. The church can no longer say that homosexual sex is a sin, because that would be contrary to what the law says. The schools can no longer say to their kids that there was something abnormal about a homosexual parent. Or the school, more to the point, cannot say that only heterosexual parents are abnormal. Skills will be required to teach the opposite, as they are in the United Kingdom today, where people who were running an adoption centre were removed because they refused to preach that homosexuality was the norm. Where in the case of Liddell, a registrar of civil marriages, working for the council in a county called Islington of London, she was employed by the council prior to the making of the Civil Partnership Act in England. She made it clear upon the enactment of that particular Civil Partnership Act, which allowed gay people to get married, that she did not wish to perform a ceremony or to register gay marriage, homosexual marriages, because he said it's contrary to her beliefs and that it offended her conscience based on her understanding of her obligation to her religion. She was dismissed. Yet there was no attempt to stop homosexuals having their ceremony registered. There was no attempt by anybody in the council to somehow say you can't have your ceremonies at this council. It was only an attempt by one woman who said, I wish not to be put in a position where I have to conduct those ceremonies. And someone else who had no objection would conduct the ceremony. The council found that that was not sufficient. The council insisted she had to perform the work in order to maintain the equality between all people, in order not to show that the council was discriminating. So her right, despite this international law of religious liberty was not being recognised. And the law of England overruled the international right of religious liberty. Likewise, in the case of McFarlane and the Relate organisation, which was given counselling to people experiencing sexual difficulties, McFarlane made clear to his employer that he did not wish to give counselling to homosexuals in their sexual difficulties. The council sacked him. For the same reason that it did not believe that the laws of England would permit the council to treat anybody less than equal. So you can see that there is a threat that comes from this idea that when the law says that same-sex marriage is okay, all other laws, including employment laws and discrimination laws, will be amended accordingly. Where you no longer will have the right to manifest your religious belief. Well, you have, but at the punishment of what the law might dish out to you. And so it's in these circumstances that we must understand what it is that we're being confronted with. It's in these circumstances that you have to reflect, not so much on the making of bad laws or the making of good laws, but what is your role? To what extent do you want to be involved? To what extent do you say to yourself, I am a creature of God, and God has given all of us a free will. And so if someone chooses to live a lifestyle of homosexuality, is it my position to judge or to somehow condemn these people when God has given everyone a free will? And what is my role as lay people in the community? What do I say? Then I say I should lead by example. I say I should not abandon the fundamental truths. I say that I will stand up for what I believe. But more to the point, that's as far as I take it. I lead by example. I demonstrate that the belief that I have is a superior belief, because from that belief will come a betterment to society. From that belief that God wills that we live in peace and we seek peace, and God wills that the preordained creatures made by God in fact serve the betterment of all people, then we search for those things. We search for those obligations. We search for those opportunities to put into practice what we believe. And that's a challenge we all face. You have got greater challenges than what I have, I presume, because you've got a lot longer to go than what I have. But don't underestimate the challenge. Don't underestimate the thrill of being able to stand up and say, I am different. I believe in something, not because it's been preordained in the Bible or the Gospel, but because, based on reason, this lifestyle will lead to a better outcome than your lifestyle. That the lifestyle of God, based on some certainties in one's life, at least gives you security. Compared to moral relativism, which is here today, gone tomorrow, where does the certainty lead you? That same Lord Patton that I referred to before, once the governor of Hong Kong, when he was defending himself, he said this: I don't have any doubts about my faith. And this is what he was criticised for. He said, I don't have any doubts about my faith. I know what I believe. But I'd be terrified if I had some doubts, because he wouldn't know where he would end. He wouldn't know where he was going. He wouldn't know on what basis, on what standard, he would make decent decisions for everybody's benefit, not just his own. And that's where faith takes us. That's where the calling of God takes us. That's where this understanding of being able to defend religious liberty takes us. To understand what the issues are clearly, and to articulate in the opponent, not by prejudice, not by bias, but by strength of reason, a virtue that has been given to us from God. I'm happy to answer any question on anything at all, other than what happened in my household, where I'm totally ignored. Any other questions, I'm happy to answer.